Welcome to today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, March the 5th, 2024. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here's our first story from the Mason City Globe Gazette. It's entitled, A World of Rhythm. World music drumming classes draw interest at Music Man Square. It's written by Robin McClellan. Teresa Jacobson spent years teaching music to children at the public school in Nora Springs and then Newman Catholic Schools. Now, she's bringing world music drumming to North Iowans. A test class was conducted over the last few weeks, with participants gathering each Wednesday afternoon to learn the basics of the drumming style. 15 people attended the February 28th class at the Music Man Square, and the rhythm of the music emanated throughout the space. Jacobson brings high energy to her classes and teaches her students to learn alongside each other. I'll be leading the changes, she said during the session, but find someone to watch in your group so you stay on beat. Students play one of three styles of tubano drums, a cylindrical drum styled after African drums. The tubano was designed specifically for world music drumming, and each can be tuned to pitch. Drummers started off slowly, with Jacobson teaching them how to hold their hands to produce different sounds. She taught them to follow the sound of the cowbell metronome. She also taught them simple structures like echo, question and answer, and other ways to make their drums speak. By the time students visited class Wednesday, they were ready to put their skills to the test as Jacobson blended the techniques together to produce a mighty wave of sound. Dale Mills plays euphonium in the New Horizons band, which meets each Wednesday for rehearsal. Teresa kind of roped me in, he said. Band practice is right after, and this is just a half an hour or so right before. I decided to give it a try, and I'm glad. Mills's children attended Nora Springs schools, so he's familiar with Jacobson's friendly and attentive style. It lets you build on the skills you already have, and it's so easy, he said. Complementing the sound of the drums and our other percussion instruments, such as the cowbell, a double bell known as gengui, and a gourd-style shaker called shakir. Together, they create a full, rich sound. Jacobson says the class has been a great success. We saw people joining in for the first time at nearly every class. It's been nice to see. We'll have another class start just after spring break. Watch our website or Facebook page for upcoming dates. The World Music Drumming class is a multi-week course that takes place at 2:30 p.m. Wednesdays. New Horizons band practice follows immediately after. Call the Music Man Square at area code 641-424-2852 for more information. The other article on the front page of the Gazette this morning is entitled, High Court Says Colorado Can't Kick Trump Off Ballot. Iowa GOP celebrates as justices say states can't remove former president. It's written by Caleb McCullough. Iowa Republican politicians celebrated the U.S. Supreme Court's Monday decision that states cannot remove former President Donald Trump from a ballot over claims that he incited an insurrection, claiming a win for the embattled candidate who was on track to clinch the Republican nomination. The ruling overturned a decision by the Colorado Supreme Court that would have precluded Trump from appearing on the ballot in Tuesday's primary election. The Colorado court found that Trump was not able to appear on the ballot because of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which bars individuals who have engaged in insurrection from holding office again. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds called the Colorado decision an attempt to subvert the will of the voters in the 2024 election in a statement Monday. The decision of who should serve as president belongs to the voters. Not only would this disenfranchise Coloradans, but Iowans as well, who believe Donald Trump is the best candidate on the ballot, Reynolds said. Frivolous attempts like this to harm the integrity of our elections should be struck down in similar fashion. Individuals and activist groups lodged lawsuits in several states challenging Trump's eligibility to be on the 2024 election ballot. They alleged that his role in inciting the January 6th insurrection, in which a mob of his supporters broke into the Capitol in an attempt to stop the legitimate certification of President Joe Biden's electoral votes, disqualified him from holding office under the 14th Amendment. In its decision on Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously ruled Congress has the sole discretion of enforcing the 14th Amendment. Because of that, state courts do not have authority to remove someone from the ballot for engaging in insurrection, the court said. The court's three liberal justices said in a concurring opinion that they agree with the central ruling, but they think the court considered more questions around the 14th Amendment than were necessary. Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd, who endorsed Trump before this year's caucuses, called the ruling a victory. "First, we won in court. Now, we're going to win at the ballot box," Byrd said on social media. "Let's bring home the biggest victory yet for President Trump this November." Republican Party of Iowa Chair Jeff Kaufman said the ruling preserved the rights of the voters to decide in the 2024 election. The Supreme Court unanimously affirmed what we all saw as a brazen, unconstitutional power grab attempting to cause election interference, Kaufman said in a written statement. "The checks and balances worked against an unbalanced and unhinged effort to trash the Constitution and take away the right of people to vote in a free and fair election." The Iowa Democratic Party did not immediately respond to a request for comment on Monday. While there has been no similar challenge to Trump's ballot eligibility in Iowa, Republican lawmakers are moving to insulate him and other presidential candidates from such challenges in a proposed election bill. Among the many changes to election laws in the bill, it would dictate that a presidential candidate's ballot eligibility can only be challenged based on the legal sufficiency of the certificate of nomination. It would also remove a rule that federal candidates must sign a statement indicating that they are aware they are disqualified from holding office if they have been convicted of a felony. Republicans have said the bill will protect presidential candidates from overzealous judges, while Democrats decried it as a move to protect Trump from legitimate legal questions. Republican Representative Bobby Kaufman of Wilton, the floor manager of the House bill, said the ruling affirms his argument that judges should not be deciding who is eligible to be on the ballot. Kaufman was a senior advisor to Trump's 2024 Iowa caucus campaign. "I have been saying all along that it is not the job of activists on the far right or far left to pick who the party's nominees are," he said. "That is the will of the voters. My friends on the other side of the aisle seem to think that activists should subvert democracy and choose who's on the ballot." Kaufman said he still thinks the provision limiting ballot challenges for presidential candidates is necessary. The language came from a proposed Secretary of State bill, and Kaufman said he wants to ensure that state law matches up with federal court precedent. Kaufman said he expects the House to vote on the bill on Tuesday. Members of Iowa's congressional delegation also celebrated the decision on Monday. Senator Joni Ernst, a Republican, said the American people should decide in a social media post. GOP Representative Ashley Hinson, who endorsed Trump after the January caucuses, also showed her support for Trump on social media. "I was proud to sign an amicus brief in support of President Trump's Colorado ballot disqualification appeal and am glad the Supreme Court reversed this disastrous decision and stood up for American voters and our Constitution," she said. "Voters decide elections, not liberal court justices." Our next story is entitled, "Armed Standoff in Swaledale Ends When Suspect Surrenders. Subject Taken into Custody Peacefully." This is written by Jacob Schaefer. An armed standoff in the Cerro Gordo County town of Swaledale ended without injury Monday when a male suspect surrendered. The Cerro Gordo County Sheriff's Department received the initial call of a man outside a home in Swaledale, visibly upset, screaming and yelling at 10:53 a.m. Monday. When deputies responded, they approached John Jackson, age 43, of Swaledale, before a struggle ensued. Both parties retreated, Jackson into his home on Main Street. Deputies learned firearms were in the home along with Jackson's wife and dog. A short time later, the woman left the home. A standoff ensued. Squad cars, undercover cars, supporting canine units, and the county's armored truck filled the streets around the residence. Officers donned bulletproof vests and helmets and carried rifles and riot shields. The standoff lasted 2 hours before Jackson peacefully exited the house and was placed under arrest. Jackson was charged with attempting to disarm an officer and was being held in the Cerro Gordo County Jail on Monday night with bonds set at $5,000. Tim Wise has lived in Swaledale 25 years and said it was the first time he has seen Main Street blocked with squad cars. "This is something strange to us," Wise said about the large law enforcement presence. "Just totally nuts." Living about a block from Jackson's house, Wise said Jackson has done work for him in the past, and Jackson's children regularly play together with Wise's grandchildren. Wise said his daughter, who works at the Swaledale post office around the corner from Jackson's house, called him around 10:30 a.m. about an incident developing down the street. Similarly, Joyce Anderson of Swaledale received text messages from her neighbors shortly after hearing the police sirens coming through town Monday morning before getting an order to shelter in place. "This is all totally unexpected," Anderson said, "and totally crazy for this town. I never heard of anything like this before." Anderson said Jackson has always been friendly and active in the community. "The best case is that he comes out and gets the help he needs," Anderson said during the two-hour standoff. The West Fork Community School District, of which Swaledale is a part, had a 1 p.m. early dismissal Monday. Aware of the standoff, school officials made arrangements to reroute buses bringing students back to town, but ultimately no action was needed. Next, Hermanson to run for Iowa House District 59. Christian Hermanson of Mason City is running in the Republican primary on June 4th for the House District 59 seat in the Iowa legislature. Hermanson said in a press release that he is running because he believes it is time for new leadership in House District 59 and the next generation should take the baton. "The citizens deserve a representative who will effectively carry their voices to the Capitol in Des Moines, and I am ready to accept that challenge," Hermanson said. "I am running to be a representative that will lower the tax burden on Iowans, increase public safety, improve our infrastructure, and take the concerns of my constituents to the State House." The seat is currently held by Representative Sharon Steckman, a Democrat from Mason City, who announced last month she will not seek re-election. A native of North Iowa, Hermanson is currently assigned as a reserve senior leader with U.S. European Command in Stuttgart, Germany, and will retire at the rank of Chief Master Sergeant. He has deployed around the globe multiple times throughout his career in support of operations in the global war on terror. Hermanson will retire from the U.S. Air Force this spring after 29 years of service. In his civilian career, he works in property management and has previously served as police officer with the Department of Veteran Affairs in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hermanson lives in Mason City with his wife, Angela. The couple have two adult sons and three beautiful granddaughters. For more information about Hermanson and his campaign, visit www.hermansonforiowa.com. Sierra Club says paid pipeline bills of counties grow. Club says company owes counties $60,000. In a news release, the Iowa chapter of the Sierra Club accuses Summit Carbon Solutions of falling behind on thousands of dollars in reimbursements to Hancock and other Iowa counties related to its proposed CO2 pipeline. The Iowa Sierra Club said its investigation has uncovered that the Delaware Incorporated Company has accrued nearly $60,000 in unpaid bills, several months old, that are owed to more than a half dozen Iowa counties. Most of the delinquent invoices relate to preparatory work completed by county inspectors, which Summit is required to repay. Citing one example, the Iowa Sierra Club said it found Summit had an outstanding bill of $15,000 to Webster County. It maintains this failure to compensate local communities appears to contradict Summit's recently stated claim that its proposed carbon pipeline project would provide economic benefits to Iowa counties, which Summit had said would help schools, improve the area, and support the local township. "We've said all along that Summit lacks ethics and integrity, but this is just another slap in the face," said Dan Tronchetti, a landowner facing the threat of eminent domain. "During a time where many Iowans are struggling just to survive, there is no excuse for a purported multi-billion-dollar corporation to not pay its bills on time." Summit's permit application in Iowa is still under review by the Iowa Utilities Board. In other pipeline-related news, Dickinson County drafts pipeline ordinance with hopes to avoid a lawsuit. Dickinson County is considering a carbon dioxide pipeline ordinance that is less restrictive than others in Iowa that have been challenged in court in an effort to regulate the pipelines without getting sued, according to county officials. Specifically, the latest draft of the Dickinson ordinance requires the pipelines to be placed at least 1,600 feet or 3/10 of a mile away from cities. Other ordinances that are subject to litigation require a 2-mile separation. That might help the county avoid lawsuits that have embroiled 5 other counties that adopted similar ordinances in response to a pipeline proposal under consideration by state regulators, said Megan Cardell, Zoning and Environmental Health Administrator for Dickinson. We did not zone it out of the county, Cardell said of her latest draft ordinance. I'm hoping somebody doesn't sue us and that they play ball. They could make something work. The ordinance is set to be considered March 18th by the county's Planning and Zoning Commission. If it gets the commission's approval, it could be subject to a vote by county supervisors in April and become effective in May. Many counties that are in the path of Summit Carbon Solutions' sprawling pipeline system have considered adopting restrictions about where the pipe can be laid. That has often been in response to residents' concerns about public safety if a catastrophic pipeline break leads to a massive release of carbon dioxide. Counties are also concerned about whether the system might interfere with city growth and economic development. Summit wants to build a 5-state system that would transport captured carbon dioxide from about 50 ethanol plants to North Dakota for underground storage. It has sued 5 Iowa counties in federal court, Emmett, Kossuth, Palo Alto, Shelby, and Story, for their ordinances. Summit was successful in 2 of the lawsuits, but the judges' decisions have been appealed. The 3 other suits are on hold pending resolutions of those appeals. Summit declined to comment on Dickinson's ordinance or about whether it might sue if it is adopted. The ordinance would also set minimum separation distances from homes and other buildings occupied by people at 1,600 feet, although the owners of the structures could sign waivers to allow less distance. Other minimum distances include a 1/2 mile from churches, schools, nursing homes, medical facilities, public parks, and other sensitive areas, 1,000 feet from livestock operations and certain utility infrastructure, and 200 feet from wells. Cardell said Dickinson's proposed procedure for a pipeline company to obtain a county permit is also less cumbersome than the other ordinances. It's unclear how much the new ordinance would affect Summit's route. Its proposal that is under consideration by the Iowa Utilities Board includes a path that narrowly skirts the town of Superior. The route further appears to be within 1,600 feet of Terrell and too close to a county park. There are also numerous farmsteads near the route. The board is poised to decide whether to issue Summit a permit for its initial proposal. The company's plans have since expanded to include more ethanol plants. Summit must also obtain permission for its project in the Dakotas. Now we'll turn to the opinion page in the Gazette, and we've got another view from the Los Angeles Times entitled, Public Needs Some Answers on $20 Wage. Did Panera Bread get an exemption because of campaign dough to California governor? Even before California Governor Gavin Newsom signed the landmark law in September that would increase the minimum wage for fast food workers to $20 per hour starting in April, eyebrows were raised over the so-called Panera exemption. The law was designed to boost pay and improve working conditions for employees of fast food chain restaurants, but it contained an oddly specific carve-out. It wouldn't apply to restaurants that bake and sell bread as a standalone item on the menu. Now, Bloomberg reports that Newsom pushed behind the scenes for the exemption, which will benefit billionaire Greg Flynn, a campaign donor and business associate who owns 2 dozen Panera Bread locations in the state. Flynn runs one of the world's largest restaurant franchise operations and was a vocal opponent of the law, which sets a fast food worker wage and creates a fast food council that would hike pay in future years and develop labor, health, and safety standards for the covered restaurants. Flynn, who also attended the same high school as Newsom, contributed $160,000 combined to the governor's 2021 anti-recall campaign and his 2022 reelection. That's a lot of dough. When questioned about the bread exemption last year, Newsom dismissed it as part of the sausage-making of politics. Amid rising outrage last week, Newsom's office put out a statement calling the Bloomberg story absurd and suggesting that Panera is not exempt from the law because it mixes the dough at an off-site location and only bakes and sells the bread at the restaurant. Okay, but we're going to need some proof, because the carve-out for bakeries has been reported numerous times using Panera as the example of a restaurant that would benefit from the exemption. The governor's office has yet to explain publicly why the bakery exemption was even warranted. And Assemblymember Chris Holden, a Democrat from Pasadena, who carried the bill, said he had nothing to do with devising the bread break. Newsom and legislative leaders need to explain themselves. This sounds exactly like the kind of legislature shenanigans that undermine public confidence. Lawmakers should expect to explain why an exemption from any new law is necessary. But it's difficult to imagine how this one could be justified. How does it make sense that if a restaurant bakes bread for sandwiches, its workers deserve $20 an hour, but if it sells it as a loaf, its workers don't? If you were thinking, well, why doesn't McDonald's just start selling the McBaguette in California to avoid the law? The exemption applies only to restaurants that operate on-site bakeries as of September 15, 2023. This is really a half-baked idea anyway. Anyone who works for Panera or another exempted chain restaurant bakery can easily switch to another eatery that pays the new minimum wage. This idea is so crummy, it could have risen only in Sacramento. Now we turn to today's obituaries. First, we remember Scott Leslie McGowan, age 74, of Mason City, who passed away January the 13th at Mercy One Medical Center. A memorial service will be held at 2 p.m. Saturday, March the 9th at First Covenant Church, 411 South Ohio Avenue in Mason City, Iowa. Next, we remember Tammy J. Hirv, H-I-R-V, age 53, of Rockford, Iowa, who died Monday, February the 26th at her home. Memorial services will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, March the 8th at Zion Lutheran Church, 805 East Main Avenue, Rockford, Iowa. A gathering for friends and family will be 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, March the 7th, and again 1 hour prior to services at the church. Fullerton Schumberg Funeral Home and Cremation Services, 302 West Main, Rockford, Iowa, is handling the arrangements, and they can be reached at area code 641-756-3311 or online at www.fullertonfh.com. Now we remember Lauren E. Kalkorf, age 91, of Garner, who passed away peacefully on Thursday, February 29th at Concord Care Center. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday, March the 6th at Zion Evangelical and Reformed Church in Garner, with Reverend Brian Lund officiating. Burial will be in Concord Township Cemetery. Visitation will be held 1 hour before the service time at church. Cataldo Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Hope Ministries in Des Moines. Next, we remember Kathleen Pat Ziesmer, age 93, of Clear Lake, who died Thursday, February the 29th. A funeral mass will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, March the 8th, at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Clear Lake. Burial will be in Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation will be held 1 hour before the service at the church. Cataldo Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Memorials can be made to the Pat Ziesmer Memorial Fund in care of David Ziesmer at 2285 260th Street in Garner, Iowa. Donations may also be made to St. Patrick's Church Youth Ministry in Clear Lake, Iowa. And Cataldo Funeral Home is www.cataldofuneralhome.com. And we remember Diane L. Deathmers Paca, age 83, of Garner, who died Saturday, March the 2nd, at Concord Care Center in Garner. A funeral mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March the 9th, at St. Wenceslas Catholic Church in Duncan. Burial will be at St. John's Catholic Cemetery in Duncan. Visitation will be held from 3 to 7 p.m. Friday, March the 8th, at St. Wenceslas Catholic Church, with a scriptural wake service at 2:30 p.m. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Diane Paca Scholarship Fund or the donor's charity of choice. Cataldo Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements, and you can find more information at www.cataldofuneralhome.com. Now we'll take a quick look at sports. First, in high school boys basketball, Lake Mills advances to state semis with wire-to-wire win. Lake Mills needed everything it could get in the final few minutes after seeing a 15-point lead dwindle to 2, but the Bulldogs held off North Union for a 58-50 win in the Class 1A state quarterfinals on Monday afternoon at Wells Fargo Arena. After leading the entire game, Lake Mills started the fourth quarter with a bucket from Aiden Stensrud to build the lead up to 15, its biggest of the game. From there, North Union held the Bulldogs scoreless for nearly 5 minutes and went on a 13-0 run. Stensrud, who finished the game with 11 points, ended the drought with a putback to seal the win. The junior center was one of four Bulldogs in double figures in the game. Lance Helming led the team with 15 points, while Logan Bacon added 13 and Eli Menke had 10. Bacon hit 2 3-pointers in the first half to build up a double-digit lead before the Warriors went on a 16-5 run. Helming opened up the third quarter with 7 straight for Lake Mills, and it was all the separation it needed on the afternoon. Lake Mills advances to play Bellevue Marquette in the semifinals on Wednesday. Luther's McDonough makes nationals. The term love might have been Luther College sophomore Clayton McDonough being sarcastic. Hating it might be too strong a phrase for McDonough to use after he fell into a familiar predicament Thursday at the Division III Lower Midwest Regional Championships at the Alliant Energy Powerhouse. Seeded second in the tournament and favored to earn his first ever trip to the NCAA Championships in 2 weeks in La Crosse, Dave McDonough was upset in the quarterfinals. The loss put McDonough and his hopes and dreams of wrestling for a national championship behind the eight ball. But then it struck him. He's pretty good at wrestling on backside. And McDonough did what he does best. He went out and won 4 straight consolation matches 1 day later, Friday. The fourth, a 1 minute 30 second pin of North Central College's Javen Estrada, last year's 149-pound national runner-up, to place third and punch his ticket to La Crosse. The Nora Springs native medaled at the state wrestling championships 4 times for Central Springs, and 3 of those medals were earned the hard way. As a freshman, he took 4th after losing in the semifinals. He lost in the finals as a sophomore, but as a junior, took a loss in the quarterfinals before winning 4 straight matches to finish 3rd. His senior, again, he lost in the semifinals, and again he went 2-0 on the backside to finish 3rd. The victory in the third-place match Friday was redemption of sorts for McDonough. A year ago, after 30-plus win season as a freshman for the Norse, he lost to Estrada in the 149-pound semifinals at the regional tournament and had to settle for 5th and no NCAA trip. McDonough will head to La Crosse on March 15th and 16th with a 36-6 overall mark, including 14 falls, 6 majors, and 7 technical falls. 3 of his 4 victories in consolations this week were by fall. The elation of qualifying for the NCAA championships was almost doubly as nice for McDonough, but his twin brother Bryce lost a 1-0 decision to Dustin Boren of Loras College in the third place match at 165. That's all the time we have for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette. A reminder that you are listening to the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to the Fort Dodge Messenger. And our top story is entitled, The Hallelujah Girls to Take the Stage, Hawkeye to Perform Dinner Theater This Week. It's written by Brandon Rushke. The Hawkeye Community Theater will be holding performances of the play, The Hallelujah Girls, from Wednesday through Saturday. An accompanying dinner will be served for the Thursday through Saturday shows, with roast beef or stuffed chicken breast as the main entrees. The Hallelujah Girls is a comedic play written by Janie Wooten, Jesse Jones, and Nicholas Hope. The story is about a group of friends who meet at a day spa every week. After losing one of their close friends, the group decides to put in the work to achieve their dreams while hilarity ensues. The five friends are played by Linda Weiland, Jess Barkus, Joan Meyer, Mary Jo Lopp, and Heidi Nilsson, with the rest of the cast being filled out by Carrie Horn, Jay Price, and Rex Daisy. Last year I did The Sweet Delilah Swim Club from the same playwrights, and I really liked how they tell a story and how it's really meaningful and feels true to life, said Stephanie Coble Day, the play's director. So I was looking for a similar show. This was actually recommended by a cast member of last year's show, and she's in this year's show. It was just appealing because of the subject matter. It's true to life and it's funny, which is appealing to a lot of people. When speaking with Coble Day about what goes into running a production like this, she said, "Well, first is the casting. I think that one of the most important roles of the director is to cast the right people that will really bring those characters to life. So the audition part of the process is pretty important to me. So after it's casted, then we start working on blocking and staging and really helping the actors bring out the best in those characters by what they have to offer through their skills," she added. "It's just a lot of fun to spend time together in rehearsals. This is a really nice cast I get to work with. They really want to put on a good production. So that makes my job easy when you've got a good cast and they're really committed to the show." Coble Day said she is hoping as director to help the actors learn and grow their skills and learn and grow in their capacity. So sometimes you're putting them in parts that they maybe feel a little uncomfortable in, so they have to stretch themselves and you help support them through that, she added. Or you just encourage people that may not have the same amount of experience or let them realize that they are doing a really great job and build up their confidence so they understand they're doing a good thing. So for me, it's so many different areas to cover. Plus, I'm really into design aspects, making sure that the set and the props and the mood of the show really enhances the script, and I really like that. So let's just do all of it. This year marks the 25th season at Hawkeye Community Theater's current location at 521 North 12th Street. When speaking a little about this milestone, Coble Day said, "We're really excited about the season. Coming to community theater is such a great way to support the arts, and we're really blessed to have a really great art scene in Fort Dodge," she added. "And we just encourage people, even if they've never seen a production, to come in and watch, and you might really, really enjoy it. You might see yourself on stage, or you might have some friends that are in the audience. But it's a great way to support the arts and celebrate our 25th season of Hawkeye Community Theater in their current location. And just, it's a great way to laugh and maybe de-stress for a few hours from all the stresses of the world. So allow yourself to have some fun, laugh, and enjoy seeing a production that's been put on by a great group of volunteers and amateurs in Fort Dodge. The shows will begin at 7 p.m. each day, with the dinners beginning at 6 p.m. on the days they are offered. There will be a 2 p.m. matinee on Saturday. Tickets for the show alone are $10. Tickets for the dinner and the show are $37. Meals are provided by Tea Time of Fort Dodge. Our next article from The Messenger is entitled "Local TV Icon Uncle Dick Dies." Johnson hosted show on Fort Dodge station KQTV. This is written by Paul Stevens. Uncle Dick has died. During the 1960s, Richard Clark Dick Johnson put smiles on the faces of hundreds of Fort Dodge girls and boys and helped many of them usher in another birthday, made all the more special by celebrating it in live television. Johnson died in Great Falls, Montana at the age of 95. "We lost our dad, but everyone lost their Uncle Dick," said Johnson's daughters, Martha Kersberger of Fort Dodge and Joan Drewers of West Babylon, New York. "We're proud of our dad and the happiness he brought to children and so many others during his life. He brought a smile to so many faces during his time on earth. He lived a full life. As the song goes, he was one of those people who need people. They're the luckiest people in the world. There is a great amount of comfort that accompanies the condolences we receive from the people whose lives our dad touched and left lifetime fond memories of him. We will miss him dearly. Those lucky kids who appeared on Uncle Dick's Funhouse are now in their 60s and 70s. Those kids were the highlight of my whole life, Johnson said in 2018 Spotlight interview in The Messenger. The main focus of the whole show was kids who had a birthday. I was just there. The show wasn't about me. It was about the kids. Uncle Dick's Funhouse was an idea conceived by Edward J. Breen, a Fort Dodge attorney and Democratic state legislator who owned KVFD Radio and purchased KQTV Channel 21 in 1953. In those early days of Breen's ownership, Johnson recalled KQTV was taking an off-air feed from WHO-TV in Des Moines and received its NBC programming lineup with some local time for news and its own programming. Eve Rubenstein filled an hour with her popular Eve's Kitchen cooking show, and a half hour opened up with nothing local to fill. Ed called me into his office, and in his usual casual way, he said, "Starting next Monday, you'll have the 5 to 5:30 slot after Eve to do a kiddie show," said Johnson, then a newscaster. Breen said he could get a contract for some cartoons and old one-reelers for such talents as Laurel and Hardy. "We built a set, ran some promos to have parents write in to schedule a birthday party on the show, which Ed named Uncle Dick's Funhouse. We didn't even have videotape at the time, so we had to do all the promotions with slides and old-fashioned opaque cards. Fortunately, I had frittered away too much time in my high school history and English classes doodling caricatures and similar pencil drawings, so Ed suggested I draw pictures for the kids and fill the time between commercials and film. The show was televised from 5 to 5:30 p.m. 5 days a week, and it ran for more than 6 years. My favorite part was interviewing the kids," Johnson said. "There wasn't a day gone by that didn't have a guest group, a birthday party. Parents would call and schedule a birthday some months ahead. I interviewed the kids and asked what their interests were, names of their pets. That was fun. I will never forget one boy who told me he used to have a dog, but that the dog pooped on his mother's dress and she made him get rid of it. I shared that with Art Linkletter's Kids Say the Darndest Things, and he used it. I'd ask them what they'd like me to draw. When Eve did some cooking, we would let the kids sample it. It was one of the most watched shows in the territory for all the time we did it." Johnson grew up in Eagle Grove, where he attended high school and junior college. Blessed with a good voice, he was doing broadcasting and commercials while attending Drake University in Des Moines. He left college for a job as a disc jockey and later news director at a Spencer radio station, then worked at a Carroll radio station before coming to KVFD Radio in 1953. He married Gladys Wilson in Harcourt, and they had four daughters, Karen, who died in 2015, Donna, who died in 2020, Joan, who lives in West Babylon, New York, with her husband, Bill Drewers, and Martha, who lives in Fort Dodge with her husband, Bob Kersbergen. Martha recalled being on the show once. "It was not my birthday, as my dad interviewed each child, asking their name, favorite subject, etc. He got to me and said, 'You know who I am.' And I said, 'You know who I am, Dad.' Well, he was supposed to be everyone's uncle and not a dad. I blew his cover. It was fun growing up with a dad who was a celebrity." Johnson was a barbershopper for more than 70 years, singing in such quartets as the Cord Huskers and the Bunker House Bums. He joined the Society of Preservation, the Encouragement of Barbershop Quartet Singing in America, while attending Drake. Johnson moved to Great Falls when he took a job as a television newsman, and I fell in love with Montana, the fishing, the hunting, the outdoors. I had been in Montana all my life, and I just didn't know it until I got there. Aging forced him to give up hunting and to sell his fishing boat and fish from shore. "The only thing I got that works anymore is my voice," he said with a laugh. For years after he quit being on the air, he did commercials and voiceovers. "If the truth be known, I have been the best and worst of people, the kindest and orneriest," he said. "I have enjoyed every damn minute of it. I hope people who know me enjoyed their time with me, too." In local politics, Larson launches primary challenge. This is written by Bill Shea. An Odebolt resident is challenging State Representative Mike Sexton in the June 4th Republican primary election. Wendy Larson announced her campaign Monday, touting her strong Christian conservative values. She is seeking to unseat Sexton of Rockwell City in House District 7, which includes Calhoun, Pocahontas, and Sac counties, plus western Webster County. Saxon is seeking his sixth term. No Democrats have entered the race so far. It's time for residents of District 7 to have a representative who is present with them, listens to their concerns, makes time for them, and focuses on relevant issues to the district, Larson said in a written statement. Larson said she believes in strong families and fighting for the unborn. To me, it's about our children, she said. That means being pro-life, having and encouraging strong families, knowing every decision we make will impact our kids and the future they will have. Larson said if she is elected, she will be tackling improper use of eminent domain, anti-Second Amendment laws, mandates that transgress our medical freedoms, illegal immigration, and indoctrination of children in public schools. We need someone in Des Moines who will lead on issues, whether popular or unpopular, and stand up to this nonsense, she said. Larson and her husband Chad have three children who are homeschooled. She is a deaconess at Chiron Baptist Church and a volunteer at the Mobile Food Pantry. The candidate earned a bachelor's degree in marketing from Colorado State University in Fort Collins, Colorado. And Meyer announces bid for fourth term, also written by Bill Shea. State Representative Ann Meyer is seeking her fourth term in the Iowa House of Representatives. She is running for the Republican nomination in House District 8, which includes Fort Dodge and Eastern Webster County. I take much pride in representing District 8 in the Iowa House, the Fort Dodge resident said. I've used my years of experience in the healthcare profession to pass meaningful legislation to meet the needs of Iowans. We've made great progress, but the work isn't done. It's my pleasure to announce that I'm running for another term in the Iowa House, she added. Meyer is the only candidate in the race so far for either the Republican or Democratic nominations. She was elected to her first term in 2018. She is the chairwoman of the Health and Human Services Committee. She also serves on the Appropriations and Judiciary Committees, plus the Health and Human Services Appropriations Subcommittee. Meyer grew up in Redford, Michigan. She earned a bachelor's degree in nursing from Mercy College of Detroit in Michigan. Prior to being elected to the House of Representatives, she was a clinical nurse instructor at Iowa Central Community College. She and her husband, Dr. Jim Meyer, have one son. Next is an article entitled Gas Leak Closes Part of 4th Avenue North Near St. Edmund, written by Bill Shea. A section of 4th Avenue North near St. Edmund Catholic School was closed for part of Monday afternoon after a natural gas line was broken, causing a leak. A company that was boring underground to install some conduit hit a 4-inch diameter gas line, according to Fire Department Captain Jeff Hill. He said Mid-American Energy crews were on scene quickly and called the fire department for help. The incident was reported at 12:46 p.m. Firefighters closed 4th Avenue North between 22nd Street and Martin Luther King Drive. They used meters to check for natural gas fumes in four houses and the business office of St. Edmund Catholic School / Holy Trinity Parish. We didn't get any readings whatsoever, so we didn't have to evacuate anyone, Hill said. Firefighters were on scene and continued to monitor the nearby buildings for gas fumes for about an hour and a half. The Mid-American Energy crews had to dig into the ground in three locations to get the flow of natural gas stopped. Eventually, 4th Avenue North was reopened between Martin Luther King Drive and a driveway into the St. Edmund campus. The western end of the street between that driveway and North 22nd Street remained closed Monday evening. Now we'll turn to today's obituaries. First, we remember Gary Pete Jepson, age 83, of Boxholm, Iowa, who passed away at his home on Sunday, March the 3rd. In honor of Gary's wishes, cremation rites have been accorded and there will be no services. For online obituaries and condolences, please visit www.carsonstappfuneralhome.com. Next, we remember Mark R. Wolf, age 64 of Fort Dodge, who died Friday, March the 1st, at his home, surrounded by his loved ones. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, March the 8th, at the historic Bruce Funeral Home, 923 First Avenue South, Fort Dodge. Celebration of Life will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, March the 9th at the St. Joseph's School Gym in St. Joseph's, Iowa. Father Merle Kolash officiating. Arrangements are with Historic Bruce Funeral Home of Fort Dodge. To view the complete obituary and leave online condolences for the family, please visit www.brucesfuneralhome.com. Next, we remember Diana L. Goodell of Humboldt. Service 2 p.m. Wednesday, March the 6th, Northfield Church, Fort Dodge. Visitation starting at 1 p.m. Burial in Union Cemetery, Humboldt. You can find more information at www.masonlindhart.com. And we remember Guy Hawley of Lawrence. Memorial service is 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, March the 6th at Bethany Lutheran Church in Lawrence, Iowa. Visitation 1 hour prior to the service. You can find more information at www.powersfh.net. And we remember Larry A. Nelson of Rolfe. Private family services will be held at a later date. For online condolences and obituaries, visit www.powersfh.net. And we remember Alan L. Geerdes, G-E-E-R-D-E-S, age 80, of Fort Dodge, who passed away Sunday, March the 3rd, at Trinity Regional Medical Center. A mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, March the 8th, at Holy Trinity Catholic Church. Burial will follow at North Lawn Cemetery with military rites by the U.S. Army and VFW Post 1856. There will be a visitation from 9:30 until the time of service on Friday. Lofsweiler Funeral Home is serving the family. And finally, we remember Jim Crouch, age 73, of Fort Dodge, who passed away March the 4th at Trinity Regional Medical Center. Services are pending with Lofsweiler Funeral Home. Now we turn to sports, and our top story is entitled Among the Elite, Area Athletes Recognized as Best of the Best. It's written by Dana Becker. 8 area girls basketball players have been given All-State honors for the 2023-2024 by the Iowa Print Sports Writers Association. Kiera Youngers and McKenna Sievers of Newell Fonda were joined on the Class 1A first team by Abby Capetius of Bishop Garrigan. Youngers and Capetius each earned All-State recognition for a second time. Another Mustang, Kinsey Hinders, made the second squad with Bishop Garrigan's Graceland Eastman on the third. Pocahontas Area's Jenna Vonahue was a 2A second team pick, with Algona's Lauren McLaughlin landing on the second squad in 3A. Humboldt's Morgan Mann was placed on the 4A third team. Youngers, who made the second team as a junior last winter, helped lead Newell Fonda to its eighth runner-up finish at state. A future Des Moines Area Community College softball player, Youngers averaged 15.7 points per game and 5 rebounds, shooting 58% from the field. Sievers, a senior like Youngers, was the state leader in assists per game at 9.1, adding 12 points and 3.4 steals. She shot 49% from the field, 77% from the free throw line, and 43% from the three-point stripe. After seeing Audie Crooks and Molly Joyce graduate following back-to-back state titles, Capetius led the Golden Bears to the Elite Eight for a fifth consecutive season. The senior averaged 11 points and 11 rebounds a night, adding to her third-team All-State status from a year ago. Hinders, a junior, posted 15 points, 5 rebounds, and 2.6 steals a night. Eastman, a freshman, recorded just under 17 points and 10 rebounds per contest. Vonahue ranked 4th in 2A in rebounding at 11.4 per contest, adding 12 points on 55% shooting from the field. She helped Pocahontas Area reach state as a junior and advance to regional finals this year. McLaughlin and Algona claimed the North Central Conference regular season title this season and advanced to a regional final. The junior checked in at almost 15 points and 6 rebounds a night, shooting 45% from the field and 40% from deep. Mann, a junior, who became Humboldt's all-time leading scorer earlier this year, ranked 7th in 4A in scoring at 20.2 points per game. She added 156 rebounds, 77 steals, and 58 assists, knocking down 27 triples. Solon's Callie Levine was voted Miss Basketball. Our next article is entitled North Union Boys Bow Out at State Basketball, also written by Dana Becker. An impressive rally in the fourth quarter pulled the North Union boys within striking distance of Lake Mills on Monday. The battle between the top of Iowa Conference rivals ultimately belonged to the Bulldogs, though, as they advanced with a 58-50 victory. Lake Mills will now meet Bellevue Marquette back here inside Wells Fargo Arena on Wednesday in the Class 1A semifinals. For the Warriors, their first ever appearance at state as North Union ends with a record of 22 wins and 4 losses overall. Down by 15 points to start the fourth, North Union put the defensive pressure on the Bulldogs, resulting in a 14-0 run to make it a 1-point contest. From there, Lake Mills regrouped, ending the showdown on a 9-2 burst of its own. Aiden Lofstrom scored 13 points and added 5 rebounds to lead the Warriors. Preston Gerdet contributed 11 points and 3 steals. For the Bulldogs, Lance Helming had a game-high 15 points, with Logan Bacon adding 13 and 7 rebounds. Aiden Stenstrud finished with a double-double, scoring 11 points to go along with 15 rebounds, including 5 on the offensive glass. Lake Mills controlled the rebounding battle, holding a plus 20 edge overall, while securing 11 offensive boards. They led for all but 12 seconds of the contest. Stenstrud had the back-breaking bucket off a pair of offensive rebounds, boosting the lead back up to 51-48 with under 2 to go. Helming, Jackson Gall, and Logan Bacon made a combined 7 free throws down the stretch. North Union knocked off St. Edmund in the district final before ousting South O'Brien to claim a sub-state championship. The Warriors won 37 games over the past 2 seasons after winning just 24 from 2017 to 2021. Gerdet, Danielle Fothergill, Kyan Jones, Bryce Boschorner, Lofstrom, and Cody Imiter are all set to graduate. Triton women bow out, Pilcher male honored. The Kirkwood women claimed the Region 11A title here Monday night over Iowa Central 86-63. The Eagles, who won their 4th straight regional crown, advanced to the North Central A championship game on Saturday, where they will host Southeast Nebraska for a spot in the NJCAA tournament. The Tritons see their season end with a record of 21-9. Fort Dodge senior high grad Lainey Mayle had a team-high 16 points, knocking down 3 three-pointers. She also grabbed 7 rebounds for Iowa Central. Emily Theis scored 11, Jordan Mayland had 10, and Lainey Pilcher added 9 points, 9 rebounds, 7 assists, and 5 steals. Both Mayle and Pilcher made the all-tournament team. We have to give credit to Kirkwood coach Mull. He's a phenomenal coach, and his teams are always very disciplined, ICCC head coach Sarah Dickinson said. You have to play a special game to get past a team like that, and unfortunately, we came up short. We have a lot to be grateful for this season. Iowa Central was selected 7th in the Region 11 preseason poll, and our team overcame that. This group had some big wins, tough losses, and were fun to coach. We will certainly miss our sophomore class, but we know that each will be successful in their own right. Jenna Tweet had a game-high 25 points to lead Kirkwood as Emily Dreckman added 17 points. Demetria Pruitt had 16 points and 13 rebounds, with Evans recording 6 points, 11 rebounds, and 11 assists. In the Region 11B tournament, Iowa Western topped North Iowa Area 111-89. The Revivers head to the United Tribes Tech in North Dakota on Saturday for the North Central B Championship. St. Edmund Boys in action at Dickinson. The St. Edmund Boys track and field team made the trip over to the Unidome here Monday for the Dickinson Relays. Hunter Horn finished 20th in the high jump, clearing 5'10". Anthony Vales was 28th in the 3200 and 43rd in the 1600. Aaron Hint added a 40th in the long jump with a leap of 19 feet 1.5 inches and 62nd in the 60-yard dash. Clay Baker was 47th in the 400 and Dominic McLean placed 77th in the 200. The 4x2 relay team of Hunt, J.T. Lofsweiler, Grant Gallus, and Thomas Cosgrove placed 21st in 138.45. Vallis, Liam Shannon, Thomas Nobby, and Levi Oderwestrom were 53rd in the 4x800 in 10.01.02. St. Edmund closed the meet with a 3:44.47 in the 4x4 to finish second in the fifth heat behind only Ankeny Centennial and 19th overall. The quartet included Gallus, Cosgrove, Lofsweiler, and Baker. For just a couple weeks of practice, I thought it was a good night, SEHS head coach Don Larson said. What really stood out for me is our field events. Having those guys do what they did with little to no practice really was nice. Our 4x200 team ran 4 seconds faster compared to last year at this meet, so that was good to see. Southeast Valley's Jace Hansen was 35th in the 60 hurdles, with the Jaguar 4x200 team placing 20th. South Central Calhoun's Caden Hammond finished 36th in the high jump. And that's all the time we have for today's Fort Dodge Messenger. And it brings us to the end of today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.